Mark A. Simon says on Twitter, I've been with us religiously for the last year or so. Mark, it's great to have you with us today. How are you?
Hi. I'm a little nervous. I think just like about everybody else that's out in the world right now. But this is a good distraction. Thanks for having me on.
No, I'm glad to. And, of course, the Fielding Bible, which you're part of, has come out. It's a fabulous book by ACTA Press, A-C-T-A. And we're going to talk a little bit about that in our segment. But, first of all, you and I chatted just a day or so ago about how to approach this thing. You know, we have no real games to talk about. And I think probably a lot of the statistics have been picked over pretty well. But I said, how about Tim Lincecum? His no-hitter, the first no-hitter, and I remember 148 pitches, and I don't know if you'd ever see that today, in today's game, so to speak, but I asked you to do a little research on the Lincecum no-hitter. What did you come up with?
Yeah, I decided to do it with Bent from my previous job at ESPN, Stats and Info, and a little bit from my current job at Sports Info Solutions. So a few things here, and the 148 is a good note to start out with. Baseball Reference has 87 no-hitter pitch counts out of the few hundred no-hitters that have been thrown. Of those 87, the only pitcher to have more than 148 pitches in his no-hitter is Edwin Jackson of the Arizona Diamondbacks, who threw 149 in 2010. Lincecum's 148 was second. Now, we should point out that the tone for that was set the first batter of the game when Everett Cabrera battled them for nine pitches, kind of set the tone for the whole day. A couple of nasty two-strike foul balls. It was very impressive on off-speed pitches. I was watching the broadcast. Mike Kruko was lecturing on how hitters need to hold the bat lightly when they swing, and how Cabrera was doing that well to keep his at-bat against Lincecum alive, eventually made an out. So there were two plays in this game that were really pivotal. One was, I think, the one that people probably remember the most is the Hunter Pence catch, where he made the diving catch for the last out of the eighth inning on Alexi Amarista. And that ball, I looked into the defensive data that we have at Sports Info Solutions, a ball hit to that spot where Pence made the catch at that speed is an out 47% of the time. So more than half the time, that's a hit. And Pence made a tricky, your typical kind of Hunter Pence tricky diving catch to make the play. But there was a play in the game that was tougher than that. In fact, it was the batter before, a ground ball down the third baseline. I think it was Carlos Quentin. Pablo went way over down the line, made the throw across to get the guy out through a perfect strike to first base. That ball had only a 13% chance of being an out, 87% chance hit. And I think that just goes to show you that with no hitters, chances are at some point you're going to need some good defense. And he got it that night. Of course, he did throw the 148 pitches, 27 of his swings. I got one more for you. So the home plate umpire for that game was Mark Wegner. Mark Wegner happens to have one of the tightest strike zones in baseball. He is very difficult to earn a strike against. So it's not unexpected that he would call out of balls with a guy like Lincecum pitching. The losing pitcher in the game was Edison Volquez. Edison Volquez went on to throw a no-hitter a couple of years later. How many pitches in that no-hitter? 98, 50 fewer. And wow. the umpire for that game, Bill Miller. Bill Miller has the biggest strike zone in baseball. And I think that all these things just go to show you how many factors there are that go into a no-hitter that are really somewhat beyond the pitcher's control. There's a lot that goes into it.
Wow, amazing. Mark A. Simon says, this is why you're the best in the business at doing this stuff, Sports Info Solutions. You know, it's interesting because when you said the most pitches thrown in a no-hitter, I was thinking, well, it has to be Nolan Ryan, probably. And then I said, what about Johan Santana? Remember when the Mets left him in and basically ended his career? How many pitches did he throw?
Johan threw 134. So I was looking through the ones that they don't have pitch counts for. And from that, I was surmising that the one that probably had the most was, and this is, I guess, someone who you would know, Jim Maloney, threw a no-hitter. In the 60s, he had 12 strikeouts and 10 walks in that start over 10 innings in a 1-0 win against the Cubs in 1965. I would have to think that's 200 pitches. You would have to think if you walk 10 and struck out 12, it's, you know, four balls to a walk, that's 40 right there, three strikes to a strikeout, that's 36 right there. You got to figure that he probably threw something close to 200 pitches that game.
Well, that's a good one. He's in Fresno. We should call Jim Maloney. Probably knows the answer to that. But very good stuff. And then here's the other thought I have, and really good insight, especially on the Pence and Sandoval plays. How did you figure that out? Did you watch video of it? How did you find out where the ball was?
That's what our company does. We watch those plays and we document. Where's the ball hit? How hard's the ball hit? Where was the fielder playing in the case of the infielders? For outfielders, we don't necessarily do that. All of that is charted by incredibly skilled people that we have in our company that we call video scouts that have gone on to bigger and better jobs. They're seasonal employees of our company. Certainly wishing them the best right now because to some extent they're going to be put on the lines a little bit. That's how we go about it. And then we look at historical data. Like we can tell you if a ball's hit to this spot at this amount of time, we can tell you, all right, that happened 27 times and 24 times it was an out. That's the way that we kind of check things out.
Boy, amazing. Very good stuff. Boy, very interesting. Boy, Lincecum, and I'm glad we picked that one because he was the freak. And, you know, he was. And I remember the game, and Bochy left him in there, and he wasn't taking him out. And pitch after pitch, it was painful at the end.
Can I say this? I think that when you think of him, the signature start is the playoff start against the Braves, right?
Right.
Like, that game, he was incredible.
Yeah, that was the other. We've done this day, greatest game in Giants franchise history. That's one we've done. Was it 14 strikeouts, I think?
Yeah, I think that's what it was. I remember watching that one. There have been a few days like where I kind of sat and watched with my mouth open and just like, whoa, how'd the guy do that? And for me, that at least in my ESPN time, which covered about 15 years before the last two, there's Randy Johnson's perfect game. There may be one or two other no-hitters along the way. I think Halladay's perfect game. And there's the Lincecum game. 9 innings, no runs, 2 hits, 14 strikeouts, 1 walk, 119 pitches. 2010 wow. NLDS game 1 set the tone for everything that was to come in the next few years.
Amazing. Mark A. Simon says on Twitter, you definitely want to follow him. This past week we had the Sabre conference down here, and I know with all going on, it was not as well attended as it has been in the past. But you got to see some interesting parts of it. I know it was on YouTube, online. People did mention it. Tell me some of the things that you enjoyed, especially there was a panel with Johnny Gomes, Ricky Weeks, and our own Joan Ryan, who wrote the book about Benji Molina and team chemistry. What did you take from that one?
So this was primarily an analytics-based conference, and they went up, I don't know how many people were there. I think I don't know, but there were a decent number of people watching, and you could watch it on YouTube. It should be archived on YouTube. So Joan Ryan's writing a book about team chemistry and how teams are put together, and in fact, she said that in the book, she has a chapter that is devoted just to Barry Bonds and Jeff Kent and their relationship with their teammates. So if you're a Giants fan, I think that that would appeal to you. But the thing that I was struck by was listening to Johnny Gomes talking about the idea of winning for your friends and establishing relationships and that there's like a power to it that you don't see on losing teams. He said that all the losing teams that he ever experienced, he said they were all the same in terms of like personality characteristics. The winning teams were a little different, but the losing teams all were very similar, and he could tell the difference between the two just in terms of the personalities of the people.
Interesting. The book I referred to, the Benji Molina book, then that this is her second book, her newest one on team chemistry. Also, you know, I talked to you for so many times, and I know you've got a great baseball history and a great work history, but how did all this start for you? How did you get into this thing? I know your work history, your professional history is impeccable, but how did it all start for you as a kid?
So I did this on Twitter because I was looking for something positive and encouraging people to share their baseball fan origin stories. So mine starts 4 years old, Mets-Giants game at Shea Stadium. I didn't like it very much. I couldn't tell what was going on. All I do is go like this. And I was mimicking pitchers pitching and batters batting. But then it slowly started to turn. The next year in nursery school, I hit a ball off the wall, off a chain link fence with a plastic bat, and I started to like baseball. My dad bought me baseball cards when I was six. I watched the 1981 World Series. Rich Gossage hit Ron Say in the head, and my dad had to explain to me that that was like a really serious thing. 1982, I think I've always had like a little thing for the 82 Giants. Because 82 is really my first year as a fan where I knew what was going on. And I know that the Giants had this great comeback in the second half of the season. We talked about it. And that was like my first baseball year. We bought a 1975 Topps baseball card set at a baseball card show at Shea Stadium. We went to the Hall of Fame. And then a year later, and this is one that I think will appeal to Giants fans of your age, we started writing players for autographs, and the first players that we started with were the players who were on base when Bobby Thompson hit the famous home run in 1951.
Very good.
Clint Hartung and Whitey Lockman, because Don Mueller had broken his ankle sliding into third base. So there's all that stuff. 1983, I was given the Bill James baseball abstract for the first time. That was pretty cool. I got Strat-O-Matic. Went to the game in 1985. Did the Astros score 16 runs all unearned? Of course they did. I was keeping score. It was my first piece of obscure baseball trivia. The Astros and Mets. The Astros and Mets played a game. Mets scored 16 runs all unearned. Then I started writing about baseball. I did a childhood newsletter when I was 11. That's kind of the gist of it.
There had to be a great story. Behind this, because you don't do what you do without loving the game. And I knew there was a good one in there. Yeah, I'm going to have to bring out the Strat-O-Matic game again and play some games and then report them on the weekend or something. That's a great way to learn baseball.
How I learned the 27 Yankees.
Yeah. Is that an online game now, or do they still have the cards?
It's an online and card game. As a matter of fact, we have a good relationship. My company has a good relationship with Strat-O-Matic.
Very good. Very good. Hey, great to have you on, Mark. Just always a pleasure. We'll come up with interesting things to talk about as we go through this thing, which changes every minute. And eventually, this coronavirus has got to be contained. It must be contained. And the governors are taking severe critical action as we speak of trying to isolate people so this thing doesn't spread. And that's the key to it right now. So we'll have plenty to talk about on the weekend. And we invite you on, and I appreciate you being on. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Mark. Everyone, please stay safe. And at least for now, stay inside.
Right. All right. Thank you. Mark A. Simon says on Twitter, Sports Info Solutions, The Fielding Bible is his book. If you need a book to read while you're inside, that's a good one. It's a lot of fun to read it. All right. More coming up.